Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and National Grassroots and Outreach Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined in the show by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith. We will be fielding and answering questions that were submitted by you and other listeners. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that a potential infrastructure spending package is being crafted in the House. Although both parties campaigned on the issue in 2016 and 2018, Congress and the White House have yet to make any real progress on finding agreement for the size of the package and funding sources. However, the recent passage of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Pact last week may have injected a fresh dose of bipartisan spirit to get something done on infrastructure. By a vote of 89-10, the Senate sent the president's desk a bill giving federal agencies money and tools to implement the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. The House approved the bill on December 19th with a bipartisan vote of 385-41. CBO projects that the measure would reduce deficits by $3 billion over the coming decade. That's mostly because revenue would increase by over $2.9 billion due to higher expected duties on car and truck parts that don't meet stricter trade rules. Appropriators will be working with relatively flat funding in the coming fiscal year, barring any surprise changes. Last year's bipartisan two-year budget deal allows for an increase of less than 0.4% or $5 billion in overall discretionary spending for fiscal year 2021 that begins October 1st. That pales in comparison to the 4% increase that was allowed for this fiscal year. And holding the line on non-defense spending may be particularly difficult in the coming year because total non-defense spending will be limited to an increase of $2.5 billion under the new budget caps, which is likely to be eaten up entirely by veterans' health care and then some. That's why there's already talk of pushing for a cap adjustment for VA private health care access programs to leave room for spending increases in other non-defense accounts. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and we will be fielding and answering questions that were submitted by you and other listeners. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well, he's a regular contributor on the show. Today, we are fielding and answering questions submitted by you and other listeners. And Bob, we received a number of rather specific questions. And although I want to get to those, before we dive headlong into them, I want to work through some of the, quote, typical questions that we get, whether in the field or just overall broadly on policy issues over the years. And we'll get to having Phil Smith on in a later segment on some of those more field-facing questions. But I think it's important to cover some of the basic questions that we almost always get or routinely come up. And I'll kick it off with the most basic of basic questions, because it is still an important principle or point to understand, and that is the difference between debt and a deficit. So can you give a quick summary of what that is for our listeners, Bob?
Sure. When we talk about the federal budget deficit, it is the annual shortfall. That is the amount by which the federal government overspends the amount of revenue that it takes in. Those cumulative deficits add up to the debt. They add to the total national debt, which also includes balances in government trust funds, referred to as intragovernmental debt, and the most famous of which is the Social Security Trust Fund. That's counted as part of the overall debt of the government because it represents obligations that the Treasury has to pay people who have paid into the system and are owed benefits. So the total national debt, sometimes called the gross debt, is the accumulation of annual borrowing and the money that the government in effect owes itself through the trust funds. The total is about 23 trillion right now, with 16 to 17 trillion of that is debt held by the public, which is the money that the government has to borrow as a result of the annual shortfalls.
In your mind, Bob, is there a difference between intragovernmental debt and publicly held debt in terms of either the importance or significance of those numbers or the type of debt?
Oh, yes. It's very different. It's all debt. I mean, it's all money that the government owes. But the debt held by the public is much, much more significant as a matter of economic policy because it shows the amount that the government needs to go into the markets and borrow. And so it can have an influence on the economy, and the government has to service that debt by paying bondholders the interest that it needs to pay to get people to buy the bonds. The intragovernmental debt is a matter of internal bookkeeping. It's money that the government owes itself. So to give you an extreme example, the federal government could cancel the Social Security Trust Fund tomorrow, and nobody could say otherwise. I mean, there would be a hue and cry across the land, so I'm not suggesting that would happen. But it is simply money the government owes itself, so the government could say, nobody has a legal claim to this money, so we're going to change the rule. That's why the Congressional Budget Office, economists, every time you see the debt referred to in those projections, it's always debt held by the public because that's the money that the government actually has to go out and borrow to make good on the obligations. Debt held by the public is going up pretty substantially, so that's the number to watch. The intra-governmental debt will be shrinking over the years as Social Security draws down its trust fund and Medicare Part A draws down its trust funds.
And one of the questions that we routinely get is, who holds the debt? How much of it is domestically held versus foreign entities or governments like China or Japan, which are the two most commonly referenced when that question comes up? It doesn't have to be a specific number because I'm sure the percentage actually changes or fluxes a bit, but typically how much is held by domestic versus foreign entities?
Well, it's been fluctuating a little bit, but it's basically right now about 40% of the debt is held by foreign investors. And that's been fluctuating a bit, but it's higher than it used to be in, say, 30 years ago or that we were used to way back in the day. But as the federal government has run bigger budget deficits, we've had to issue more debt, and foreign investors, whether they're individuals or foreign investment funds, sovereign investment funds, like to buy U.S. bonds because they're considered safe. And so a rising share of the debt has been held by foreign investors. But like I say now, it's around 40%.
And a follow-up question, or at least a follow-up assertion made when that question is asked is, can't Japan or China or any of those foreign governments or individuals just call in our debt whenever they want and basically screw over the U.S. economy? What are the implications of this sort of ratio of 40% held by international individuals or organizations or governments versus domestic?
I think the real consequence of that is simply that other countries would get the benefit of the investment that they're making in this country by buying our debt, rather than if we finance more of our investments domestically, then we keep that money here rather than sending it abroad is the consequence of the foreign investors earning the benefits of that investment. It does help the U.S. economy to have that money being invested here, but the investors get the the benefit also, and so the income it has an effect on income flows that would reduce domestic income and increase the income from that investment that flows abroad. As far as the political consequences of countries quote unquote calling in the debt, and I mean that's more or less the stuff of novels and interesting movies. It doesn't seem like a rational political thing. What they would do functionally is stop buying U.S. bonds. You know, I don't know if there's a mechanism for a so-called calling in the bonds. I mean, it would be if we stopped paying. But the vulnerability is that foreign countries might decide to do something else with their money. And then we would have to raise the interest that we pay on debt because we'd have to attract that lost capital. So there's a vulnerability, whether it comes from a threat or just because people decide to make different investment decisions, that the more that our debt is financed from abroad, that is, the more we're relying on borrowed capital to finance our economy, the more vulnerable we are to those investors making different decisions, which would force us to raise interest rates to attract that capital from other sources.
A follow-up question that I have is, what are the dangers or the risks of having an unsustainable growth in the nation's debt, regularly growing budget deficits that are growing at a rate faster than economic growth or revenue generation? And how do those things impact aspects of the budget, like setting priorities or using key revenues on investments in the future?
Well, the thing about budget deficits and debt is that in the short term, they can do positive things, and yet if you let them go on for too long, it affects the long term. So in order to be concerned about this stuff, you have to be concerned about the future of the country. If you sort of live for today, it's, well, you know, maybe a deficit's not a bad thing. It gives me stuff that I want, and I don't have to pay for it. But if you're younger and thinking about the long-term future of the country, the debt that is racked up ultimately needs to be financed. So it has several implications. I think probably from an economic standpoint, the one that is most crucial is that generally speaking, a budget deficit absorbs national savings to finance it. People buy more bonds rather than investing in things that might help grow the economy more directly. And so that lack of savings translates into diminished investment. The diminished investment translates into a slower growing economy, which translates into fewer jobs and slower wage growth over time, and that translates ultimately into a lower standard of living. So that's the economic case for not running perpetually expanding budget deficits. And that's not to say that a budget deficit isn't a good thing under certain circumstances, like when the economy is slow and you do want to stimulate it. So budget deficits are not always a bad thing. The other thing is it matters a lot what the government is borrowing the money for. If it's borrowing for investment purposes in new technologies and roads, bridges, investments in education, that has a positive effect on the size of the future economy. And there's more rationale for doing that, whereas if what you're doing is just borrowing the money to borrow it from, to take it from some people and give it to other people, so-called transfer payments, which is now about 70% of the budget, that has less of an economic justification. It's like if you borrowed on your credit cards to pay your grocery bills or your rent. If you're doing that, you shouldn't be doing it. It's just borrowing money for current consumption. And that's not a good thing, and is really a generational wealth transfer, taking wealth from the future and transferring it to the present. So I would say that those are the economic conditions reasons for not running very large budget deficits. The effect on the budget itself, what's happening now is that, you know, interest costs will go up to service the higher debt, even with low interest rates as we have now, and it will tend to squeeze out investments in the discretionary side of the budget because that's the first thing to go, and that's in fact been happening, is that the annual appropriations, which contains the so-called domestic discretionary spending and national defense, that Congress appropriates on an annual basis. So it's easier to cut that than the mandatory programs which operate on autopilot, like Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. And so those programs will become an increasingly large share of the budget, and that will have effects over time, too, because you're not, you know, more of the budget is going simply to transfer payments to for health care and retirement rather than into in investments and more towards paying interest on past borrowing. And so the priorities of the budget on autopilot just get skewed towards the present and away from the future.
This conversation about debt, deficit, what we're spending money on, setting priorities, how much of a deficit there should be, when it's appropriate to have a deficit or not, I think dovetails nicely into a question that we were emailed by one of our listeners named Eric, who asked a question that pertains to, I guess, what I'll characterize as one of the arguments against reducing deficits or the nation's debt, which isn't uncommon. We've been around for over 25 years, and there's a lot of arguments that are made to have deficits or spend more or cut taxes. And one of those that has been increasingly more popular and even amongst economists in terms of discussing it is modern monetary theory, or MMT. Eric sent along several questions, and I'm going to try and synthesize them into sort of one broad topic that you and I can discuss a little bit, because I should preface it with neither of us are economists, so neither of us have a particular expertise on this topic. So I think in a segment soon, we'll have Diane Lim back on, and we can dive headlong into MMT. But I do want to bring it up because it is something that's asked a lot in the field, and it's becoming more of a counterargument to reducing deficits. And the questions that Eric brought up were basically summarized as this: why can't the government or why can't the Treasury just print enough money to meet its obligations and not worry about reducing deficits in order to achieve its budget goals?
Well, I guess we are printing money to meet the current expenses. I guess the question is, can you expand obligations and just understand that all you need to do is print the money to do it? As I understand it, you know, MMT is not an excuse for just running unlimited budget deficits by printing money. I think that there is a understanding on the part of MMT's academic proponents that would simply lead to hyperinflation over time, and that the amount of money printing you want to do is still affected by the economic circumstances and by what the government is going to do with the money. So, again, if it's for investments, then it makes more sense. If there is a demand-constrained economy, it makes more sense. So I think what the proponents are arguing is that Congress doesn't, the Fed should just keep printing the money, and that if inflation gets out of hand, the Congress should step in and control inflation by raising taxes or otherwise constraining the economy. So it kind of flips the role of the Fed and the Congress. The Congress should be the one that's ultimately controlling the monetary policy, not the Fed. And therein lies some problems, because I really have trouble imagining Congress making the sort of hard choices that would be needed to control inflation. You may recall, I do, and some may be too young to recall, but maybe you read about it in the history books, that the rapid inflation that we had in the 1970s, which I do recall, and the very high interest rates were, you know, partially brought to a conclusion by the Fed in the person of Paul Volcker, recently passed away, chairman of the Fed in those days, clamping down on monetary policy and raising interest rates to clamp down on inflation. And there was a lot of political blowback from that, and he stood firm. And the judgment of history is that he did the right thing and was rather heroic. I don't see that kind of profile and courage inhibiting the halls of Congress or the White House right now. So turning that decision over to the political branch strikes me as very imprudent.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you there, Bob. Even if you were to accept MMT at face value and institute it, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong or tell me if you disagree, but from what I understand, the whole theory is focused on making sure the economy is functioning at or near capacity, including employment and productivity and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, it still requires Congress to make key decisions at key points and junctures to control those things, whether it's controlling inflation or controlling economic capacity or productivity. And to your point on profiles and courage, it's not like Congress has demonstrated in the last 20 years that it's really willing to make those types of difficult decisions at key junctures. I mean, just look at recent changes in the tax code. We weren't even willing to pay for those or make tough decisions in relation to it. In fact, I might even draw a parallel there. It almost seems like not paying for tax cuts from the more right-leaning perspective and MMT saying deficits don't really matter as much on the liberal perspective are really just ways or excuses to avoid making some of those difficult decisions, because it's much easier politically to say, I'm going to cut your taxes or I'm going to increase spending in this program than to step up and say, it's time to make some difficult decisions. I don't know. I may be way off base there, Bob. What do you think?
No, I think you're right. I mean, this is the thing that I worry about is economic theories that are have some truth behind them that are distorted once they get into the political realm into total free lunches. So you do have the argument from tax cut advocates that, hey, tax cuts pay for themselves. And that's an exaggeration of the theory that a tax cut will help stimulate the economy, and that can do so not just in the short term, but over the long term if it's increasing investment decisions. There's certainly, as the CBO and others have documented, there's a feedback effect, a positive feedback effect from a tax cut, but it doesn't pay for itself. It's not that much. And I'm seeing the same type of political phenomenon develop here with MMT, which is, you know, less concern about budget deficits, translating into budget deficits don't matter, and we can do whatever we want and just print money, and there's no consequence to that. I think there are some MMT theorists who are saying, oh, wait a minute, now that's not what we're saying. But on the political front, it becomes, hey, let's run with this. Wow, we can just print money, and there's no, you know, we have this new theory that means it doesn't matter. So anyway, not surprisingly, academic theories can sometimes be distorted for political reasons.
It's safe to say that this topic probably isn't going to go away, so we should definitely have Diane on the show, and we can ask her all the tough questions. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We've been fielding and answering questions submitted by you, our listeners, and we're going to pick up in the next segment with Bob again, but add in National Field Director Phil Smith, and we're going to get into some more of your questions and talk about some of those topics and issues that typically come up from the field perspective. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith. We're picking up on our previous segment with Bob, in which we are fielding and answering questions submitted by you and other listeners. Welcome back, Bob and Phil.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chase. Glad to be back.
One of the questions that we got via email from Barry has to do basically with deficit reduction measures. We talked a lot about the growing debt and deficit in our prior segment with Bob, and Barry asked what specific changes we would recommend to reduce the federal budget deficit. And he put a caveat on it. He said, apart from changes in defense and taxes, which I don't know that we would necessarily cut those two things out of reforms, but it does get into a broader topic that I didn't get to talk about or ask about in our last segment, and that was the difference between discretionary spending and mandatory spending. Bob, you touched on it very briefly when you're talking about part of the budget being on autopilot and about 70% being transfer payments. So maybe before we get to what kind of reform Concord might recommend policymakers engage in, you can discuss, you know, what is discretionary and mandatory spending? How do they differ? Why do they matter?
Well, discretionary spending is the money that flows through the annual appropriations process, and it's about a third of the budget. It includes both defense and non-defense spending. The defense portion of discretionary spending is about 50%. And so you sometimes hear people say that defense is 50% of the budget, which is incorrect. Defense is about 50% of the appropriation. The other part of the budget is mandatory spending, and the distinction there is that that money does not go through the annual appropriations process. It's sometimes called entitlement spending. It's because it flows automatically. Social Security and Medicare are the two largest entitlement programs or mandatory spending items. The amount of spending is determined by the number of beneficiaries and the cost of providing whatever benefit it is that they're qualifying for, like health care. Over time, the budget has pretty much flipped in the last 30 years, going from about two-thirds going to appropriations to now two-thirds of the budget is entitlement programs or mandatory spending. And interest on the debt is also considered mandatory because the government has to pay that, but it's not a program expense.
That's right. And I'll add to that, Chase, that if you just look at the growth of that in my lifetime, I was born in 1968, and in 1968, this autopilot spending, you know, as Bob says, it was like about a third of our spending, and now it's you know, approaching two-thirds. What in 2028 it's going to be 64% mandatory plus another 11% interest. You know, for 75% of the budget in 2028 is predicted to be on autopilot. So this is happening right underneath our noses, and we know it, yet policymakers continue to do a whole lot of nothing.
Taking into consideration the trends in the budget that you just mentioned, pulling in another listener's question, Kevin from Indiana, who also asked about getting to solutions and reforms. He asked, basically, if it's bipartisan reform that's necessary, but we haven't been very bipartisan in recent years, is it more of a process reform that's necessary to get the nation on a more sustainable fiscal track? So here's the two questions combined. Broadly, what kind of reforms does Concord usually recommend? And are we at the point where we need process reform in addition to those things?
Well, I'll start off there. I had to confront these as a member of the Rivlin-Domenici Debt Reduction Task Force back in 2010. We had to look at all these questions, and the first thing that we did was decide that we wouldn't exclude things like defense and taxes, because you just can't, not just politically, but I mean substantively, to try to take the growth out of any, you know, if you're taking defense off the table and taxes off the table, that's two very main levers, and you would end up with a program that just wouldn't fly politically, because you'd have to take too much out of the other areas. Anything you exclude, you have to make up for other areas. I wouldn't take taxes off the table for this reason. A lot of the growth that we're seeing in the federal budget and we'll see in the future is a result of the population aging and qualifying for programs that were put in place, like health care and Social Security. And so that's not a matter of the government going on a spending spree or spending like drunken sailors or, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. I think we have to acknowledge the fact that if we want these programs, and I think most people do, that it's going to require a level of revenues that we have traditionally not had. And that's nothing, you know, that's not like confiscatory levels or anything, but we have very low revenues right now as a percentage of the economy, which is a good way to look at it. They're lower than the 50-year average. So we do have room for increased revenues, and there are ways to do it. There's, you know, going to be politically debates about the best way to do that. But we should not take taxes off the table, given the demographics and the fact that an older population is going to cost more money. But we shouldn't take the other program. We shouldn't take Social Security and health care, Medicare, Medicaid off the table either. I mean, they're the main source of spending growth. So any bipartisan group that's looked at that has always said you have to put everything on the table.
I would add, Chase, when you're talking about process reforms, there's a lot of things we can do to help out the process, right? And in fact, down here where I live in Georgia, our recently retired Senator Johnny Isaacson was pushing for biennial budgeting reform. So that would be helpful. And Concord has always, you know, Bob has testified many times before Congress about how these things would be more helpful. But Rudy Penner has this great quote, and he says, you know, the process isn't the problem. The problem is the problem. So we can work around the edges. There's all sorts of things that we can do to make it easier to solve the problems through process reform. But at the end of the day, the problem is the problem. And when you look at the problem, it's on both sides of the ledger, right? So as Bob was saying, you have to look at both the tax side of the ledger and having you know, good, solid tax reform and a strong source of revenue. And you also have to have spending reform. And if you're talking about spending reform long term, there are certain things that really stand out, particularly as it relates to health care. If we don't figure out a way to bend the long term health care cost curve, then we're in real trouble. So that's sort of where we prioritize.
And Phil, I've got a follow-up question specifically for you. You've facilitated a lot of Concord's interactive budget exercises over the years. You're all over the country all the time. I think pertinent to this conversation is figuring out how everyday voters address these issues. You know, we've got the political perspective and the partisan perspective. What are you seeing from the voter perspective, the citizenry? Do they look at this from a bipartisan perspective? Are they able or willing to make changes in defense or taxes or Medicare and Social Security? Or you know, is it all one-sided?
Well, we do live in a very divided country, and I feel that wherever I go. I can close my eyes and tell you when I'm in red America and blue America whenever I travel around the country. That being said, when people are armed with good facts, with good data, with knowledge, they actually tend to make really good decisions. And that's what I see in our budget exercises. Now, if they have bad information, if they think we can solve all of these problems by just eliminating foreign aid or, you know, something like that, which is a tiny percent of our budget, then that's when we start getting into trouble because they start going for easy answers. And one of the questions that I get most often, whether I'm talking to a Kiwanis Club or a Rotary Club or doing these budget events, is, you know, why haven't policymakers fixed these things? Why do policymakers continue to fail at addressing these issues? And the answer is pretty simple. It's not easy. There are no magic bullet solutions. And so once you can convince the citizens that there are no easy answers by walking them through the facts using the Concord Coalition chart talk, then they start gravitating towards substantive solutions, and they will compromise and they will sit across the table from someone who watches a different television network than they do, and it's a wonderful thing to see. That's what gives me hope, because a lot of times it can seem hopeless as we look at these problems, but when I see citizens take the time to get educated and do our exercise, they actually do better than the policymakers at coming up with solutions.
Chase, let me just throw in one process thing that I think is a good idea that's winding its way through Congress at the moment, and it's something called the Trust Act. It's sponsored by Mitt Romney and Joe Manchin in the Senate and lots of others. I don't want to rattle off all of the sponsors, but the bipartisan in both houses. And what it would seek to do is appoint members of Congress, special committees, to fix the finances of key federal trust funds that are scheduled to run dry in the next several years. And that would include Social Security and Medicare Part A and a few others. At least it would have some, it's not a cure or anything, but it would force some bipartisan attention onto potential remedies. And in order for any remedy to be adopted, it would have to have overwhelming bipartisan support.
All right, we have a few very specific questions from a listener named Molokai in Louisiana that focus on domestic investment and economic growth, and they're rather state-specific. And I think I'd like to take that question and make it more broad because I think it's an important one, and it comes down to this. How can changes in the discretionary spending areas like agriculture, workforce investment, or specific programs targeting states, how can changes in that or reductions in that impact states and economic growth nationally?
Well, I can tell you, Chase, having served as a state official, in addition to my career at the Concord Coalition, I've served as the COO of two state agencies in my home state of Georgia. And our budget in one of those agencies absolutely lived or died based on what was happening to the federal budget. The agency I worked for was the Department of Community Affairs, and 70% of that budget came from the federal government. So as discretionary spending is reduced over time, and the projections are that it will be reduced even more, states really get the brunt of that. Oftentimes it's been said that bad news travels downhill. So as things are happening up the hill in Washington, it really does affect the states. And it affects different states differently because states like Louisiana face different challenges than, say, a state like New York or California. A state like Mississippi, for example, right next door to Louisiana, really depends heavily on all sorts of federal funding. So that affects the overall growth rate of the economy. If we don't get our federal economic house in order, the states don't have as many tools and obviously aren't as big to solve the problems. So the investments that we need to make, whether it's transportation infrastructure or a variety of other spending items, have a huge effect. And that's why state leaders oftentimes look critically at federal leaders and say, please get your act together.
And I want to stay in the economic growth category for a second. Kevin from Indiana actually asked multiple questions that were on different topics. One of them has to do with a specific initiative the Concord Coalition is currently engaged in, and that is our fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. And he honed in directly on the legal immigration reform portion of that agenda. And he asks, how can businesses and the general public be empowered and encouraged to push forward on the issue of immigration reform in a bipartisan way, especially in an election year?
Well, I think that this is an important thing for people to be engaged with. I think there are a number of business groups, associations that you might not necessarily be focused on legal immigration that might want to think about taking a position to encourage it. And for reasons of helping economic growth. And they can do so in full support of strong border security, because what we're talking about here is legal immigration and trying to get more workers into the country, because our workforce growth has declined rather precipitously over the last couple of years and decades, really. I mean, it's been on a slow decline. And so what we need to do is improve legal immigration. So I think that, you know, it's best to work collectively. And that can be done through any sort of groups. I mean, I think of, it's not just business groups. I mean, I think this is something that church leaders could be involved in. It's something that community leaders, I know that a lot of states are seeing a drop-off in their populations, their workforce growth, and they really want to have new workers coming in. They need them to fill jobs. And we're not just talking about, you know, whiz-bang high-tech people that might, you know, everybody says, well, we want to bring those people into the country because they'll have new inventions and be entrepreneurs, and that's exactly right. But we also need agricultural workers. We need people for service jobs. and they want them, and this would help the economy. So, you know, a number of state governors are involved in programs to bring more illegal immigrants into the state. And so I think there are a number of avenues where people can be involved in some sort of effort, and always trying to encourage doing it from a bipartisan point of view. And like I said, again, it can be totally separate from the question of enforcing borders. I think a lot of people that are in favor of higher legal immigration also believe that that border security must be enforced. So there's, you know, just not too long ago, we had a bipartisan bill go through the Senate. I think it was in 2013, with somewhere around 70 votes that would expand legal immigration and provided lots of funding for border security. It just unfortunately never got taken up in the House.
Since we were talking about Concord's own agenda or plans, it might be worthwhile tying in one question we got from Eric in New York. It's not the same Eric from our previous segment. He asked a question that we can't really answer directly, but I think it is a good opportunity to springboard off of it. And this is simply because Concord's nonpartisan and we don't endorse candidates. But Eric asks which presidential candidate, and by the way, this is a timely question given that we're on the doorstep of the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary, but he asks which presidential candidate has the most fiscally responsible plans. So obviously, Bob and Phil, we can't name drop here, but what we can do, I think, is recharacterize this question and ask what should the candidates be talking about when putting out their plans?
Well, I think that people could look at the very helpful issue guide that we have on our website for 2020 for the candidates, and that's on our homepage. You can click through. But I think, for me, when I look at what candidates are talking about, you know, you don't expect them to come out and say that the first thing that they're going to do is reduce the deficit and start paying down the debt, because people want to talk about the ways in which they will, you know, they have big visions for the future. What I am looking at is, do you acknowledge that the rising debt is a problem that needs to be dealt with in your suite of economic proposals, and are the methods that you propose for paying for new initiatives credible? Do they add up? And it's not always very transparent, looking at campaign websites, that they do. My gripe about this right now is that a lot of candidates are talking about the need to pay for new initiatives and how they would do it, and that's a good thing. But I haven't found any yet that add up everything they're planning to do and how they're going to pay for it and show that on their website. I'm aware that they have done such things, a lot of the candidates, because they've made it available to the media in certain instances. Not everybody, but some campaigns have done that sort of exercise, but it really is something that should be available to the public to see on their websites to know if they have credible plans.
I would agree, and I would add a great question. If you run across a presidential candidate, is to simply ask them, you know, since the debt is growing faster than the economy and scheduled to continue to grow faster than the economy, what are your plans for the federal budget? And by that, I don't mean just your spending plans, but, you know, look at both sides of the ledger. What are you doing to be fiscally responsible as a presidential candidate?
Yeah, and I think I'll add on to that. You both make great points. And one question that I've been asking is the one that Bob pointed out, and Phil, your point sort of underscores, and that is, can you do what you are proposing to do and also address the underlying structural issues within the federal budget, the growing deficits, the growing debt? It's obvious that there are areas of investment that are important. It's obvious that we need to make and set priorities. It's obvious that, you know, there are going to be some challenging years ahead, but can we do all these things and not send to the next generation an incredibly heavy burden of uncontrollable debt and growing deficits? We have unfortunately reached the end of this segment. We've run out of time. There are some questions we didn't get to, definitely some topics we didn't cover. So come back to the show in the future to hear more. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and National Field Director, Phil Smith. We've been fielding and answering, to the best of our ability, the questions you submitted, as well as questions from other listeners and questions we typically get when we're out interacting with citizens across the country. Thank you for joining Facing the Future again, Bob and Phil.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.